You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Episode number 40 of That One Time on Tour is brought to you by the band Dropouts. Dropouts is a four-piece pop-punk outfit hailing from Los Angeles, California. Their sound has been described as a mix of the Ramones' melodic simplicity, Blink-182's tongue-in-cheek spirit, and the early rock and roll stylings of Chuck Berry. Their new record, Punk Sounds, was produced by Greg Hetson of Bad Religion and the Circle Jerks. For more information, please check out Facebook and Instagram at Dropouts Pop Punk. Now here it is, their new single, Dancing Shoes.
Another night stuck in snowy Cleveland. The icy potholes, streets are freezing. Let out a chances, but I can't believe it. A leader's body spent alone, surrounded by kissing couples. Your eyes are full of trouble. And I don't wanna dance with anyone but you. You give me just one night, and I will see. But you. Ooh. Another week out on the road, 1 million miles from home. Head up, eyes open and stone sober. When I get back to you, we'll know just what to do. You know the eyes. Your eyes have won me over.
What's that number?
And I don't wanna dance with anyone but you. You give me just one night, and I will see it through. If you stay by my side, then I'll be satisfied. Cause I don't wanna dance with anyone but you. And I don't wanna dance with anyone but you.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is Brandon from Rancid, and you're listening to That One Time on Tour.
Run for the road, cause it's going on and on. We'll be driving through the darkest night until the break of dawn. We'll be heading for the cities, another show for us to play. To get back in the van, cause tomorrow we'll do it. We'll do it all again.
Hello and welcome to episode number 40 of That One Time on Tour. As always, I am your host, Chris Swinney, back with another stellar conversation with someone in or around the music industry. So how's everybody doing out there, man? We're back. This is a milestone, kind of. I mean, I thought 50 is going to be cooler, but 40 episodes, that's crazy. I have an episode for each year that I've been on this earth. So this week's going to be great. I got to sit down with Mr. Brandon Steinekert from Rancid, and he also used to play in The Used. I hadn't seen Brandon since Warped Tour in 2003, and we had a really good chat. We talked about all kinds of good stuff. So before we get to that, I do want to say that we hit 100 reviews on iTunes, or Apple Podcasts, I guess is what they're pushing to call it now. But yeah, I'm really excited. That was the plan. I wanted to get up to 100. Now now I want to get to 200, but I did promise you we were going to do a contest if we hit 100 reviews. So I'm ironing out the details on the contest right now. So, you know, keep leaving reviews. If you haven't done it yet, please, you know, preferably 5 stars. You could win the contest. I'm going to have something really cool for you guys. I'll probably have it figured out by next week's episode. If not, it'll be on social media. So make sure you're following us on everything. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, everything is just at TOTOT podcast. I do need to take the time that I always do to pay the bills, to keep the lights on. I've got to tell you about my amazing sponsors. Back once again, Merge 4. They're a crazy company, man. They make socks. You know, do you know any cool designer sock companies? I do. Merge 4. They're amazing. Go on over to merge4.com or hit them up on all the social medias at Merge 4. They have collaborations with artists and professional athletes. It's just, it's a really cool place, and their socks are affordable as well. I have a pair on right now. So go on over and check out merge4.com. Next on the list, I have to tell you about Sticker Wolf. Sticker Wolf, I tell you guys every week, they're amazing. They did our logo. They've done stickers for the show. They have great affordable prices. But if, you know, if you get a hold of Sticker Wolf and you want to save a little bit more money, make sure to use the promo code TOTOT. That one time on tour, TOTOT. Just let them know that we sent you, and they're going to give you 10% off of your stickers that you get from them, or your graphic design work, or whatever you need. So check out stickerwolf.com. Muncie Music Center, still on board as a sponsor. They hook me up really well with equipment and anything that I would need for the podcast. It's a really cool store here in Muncie, Indiana. I teach guitar there. It's at 600 South Mulberry Street in Muncie, or you can hit them up on munciemusic.com. Last but not least, I have to tell you about rockabilia.com. I tell you every week, they're an amazing, amazing company. Your one-stop shop for band merch. And I guarantee if you're here to listen to Brandon talk about Rancid or The Used, they have both bands merch at rockabilia.com. So head on over to rockabilia.com and at checkout, use the promo code PCTOTOT. You're going to save 15% on that order. So thanks a lot to Frankie over at Rockabilia. We appreciate the support. I do need to tell you guys about Patreon.com. I don't push it very hard because I don't really like begging for money, but there is a lot of costs that come up with running the podcast, and it does help out. And a lot of people might think this is funny, but I'm really excited. We have 2 patrons now. You know, they've both pledged $5 a month, and that goes a really long way to help with, you know, the hosting costs and everything for the files. So if you guys want to become a patron, all you have to do is head over to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. Once again, that is patreon.com, patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. If you guys feel like what I'm doing has some merit and, you know, it means something to you and you get some enjoyment out of it, please become a patron. If not, keep listening for free, man. I'm doing it for you guys anyway, so it doesn't matter, but I could use the help if you guys can't afford to do it. I do want to give a shout out to both of our patrons, and I'm going to continue to, you know, name patrons as we get them, if we get any more. So I do want to give a shout out to David Wilkins. He's out of Texas, and Jackie Marshall. She is out of Indiana. Big ups to David Wilkins out of Texas and Jackie Marshall from Indiana. Thank you guys so much for being patrons. I'm going to be dropping some cool exclusive episodes and just different content for the patrons. So if you guys want to help us out, go on over to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. If you guys want to become a sponsor, we had this really cool band at the beginning, Dropouts. I love them, man. They were actually produced by Greg Hetson of Bad Religion and the Circle Jerks, who is going to be a future guest on this show. So go check out Dropouts. They're really cool. All the info is in the show notes and at the beginning of the episode. If you guys want to become a sponsor, if you have a band or a company, all you have to do is email me, TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll figure all the details out. So I work with all budgets, everything. Just hit me up and we will do it. So yeah, that's going to do it for me. I just want to say thank you guys so much for being a part of my life and allowing me to be a part of yours. You know, if you're driving right now or if you're just sitting at home listening to this, I appreciate you. Couldn't do it without you, honestly. I mean, I could, but it wouldn't be funny because nobody would be listening. So I'm going to jump right into my conversation right now with Mr. Brandon Steinekert from Rancid and the Used. Here we go. And I'm on the line with Brandon from Rancid. How you doing today, man?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I'd really appreciate it that you came on the show. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember or not. We met back on Warped Tour. I'm wanting to say 2003 when you were on with the Used.
Nice. Yeah, that was like the the whirlwind year, right?
Like, well, I remember you guys, I'm not sure if you guys were on, I think you were on the main stage eventually, but maybe you started on a smaller stage, or maybe it was the year before. I remember seeing you guys on the Volcom stage.
Oh yeah. So we did it in 2002 and 2003. And the first one was like, and man, it was like the smallest side stages where they were like wood crates as the stage and kept breaking shit and they'd get mad at us. And I think we played the main stage one time, like somewhere really, you know, small.
I was on the tour in 2002 as well. So I think maybe that's what I'm remembering, but I do remember I got fairly friendly with Quinn, the guitarist at the time, and hung out with Jeff a little bit. But I remember you and I, we talked a couple times, but man, it's been so long ago. I'm sure you don't remember.
Yeah, right? Like a lifetime, it feels like.
A lifetime ago. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about all that. What I'd like to do here at the beginning is I like to dig pretty deep into my guests' backgrounds as far as music goes. So like when you were small, you grew up in Utah, correct?
Yep.
What got you into music? What made you feel like you were passionate about getting into music? Like, we all have one thing that kind of does it for us. What was it for you?
You know, I mean, for me, I was so late to the game, I feel like. I grew up in a household that we had very little music, very little exposure to it. I had a very conservative Mormon family. And it was like the only music I ever heard growing up was, you know, the Beach Boys and like Kenny Rogers. You know, and it was like very minimal. And I got into skateboarding when I was 11, and that kind of was my life. And then, of course, through skateboarding, skate videos, stuff like that, you just get exposed to so much great music. And by the time I was like 15, 16, pretty deep in teenage depression and angst, you know, that was when it really was resonating and making a massive impact on my life. And some of the best records were coming out through those years that were kind of changing the game, like Nirvana Nevermind and the first Rage Against the Machine album, you know, like these were the ones that were like making me realize like, oh my God, like this is like medicine for all my problems.
And you're 40 like I am. I think we're the same age, correct?
20. Yeah. We're both 20. That's great.
Yeah, I like to say that as well.
Doesn't that sound so old to say out loud? My God.
Man, it's crazy. My wife is 13 years younger than me, and like every day since I've turned 40, she looks at me and she goes, "It's so weird that you're 40. I'm like, "Yeah, I know. It's really weird that I'm 40.
Yeah, it's so weird. But 40 is a lot younger than it used to be, I think.
Yeah.
Now that we're 40.
I feel like you know, with you and I both being 40, we probably had some of the same, you know, formidable years, like the bands that inspired us and whatnot. I know I was big into skateboarding as well. What were some of the skateboarding heroes that you had growing up?
Man, everybody from, you know, of course, Tony Hawk. I mean, he was the guy raising the bar and doing the sickest shit. Rodney Mullen has always been a favorite of mine. And then there's everybody from like my first deck ever was a Matt Hensley, H Street. Which is rad because Matt's a friend of ours and it's a trip to like, you know, I've toured the guy a bunch in Flogging Molly and it's still so weird to me. That's like, man, I had your pro deck when I was 11 years old. Like, you know, like it's so rad.
I remember being on Warped Tour with those guys. And the first time that I met him, I was like, wait a minute. You're the same guy that I had your board. I felt the same way that you did. It kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah. I honestly, the first time I met him, we were doing, it was the Let the Dominoes Fall album that we did all the acoustic versions of all of our songs as well. And Matt came over to the studio and played on a few songs. And I literally, like, I got so weird and, like, I wanted to tell him so bad and I couldn't. I just felt so uncomfortable and I was like, and I didn't even say anything about it. And then it was, like, one of the times on tour I was, like, kind of geeked out and was like, by the way, I gotta tell you, you know, like you were my first board ever and it was fucking awesome. And he was super rad about it and it was funny, but I just, for some reason, I felt so like, I got so embarrassed and awkward to tell him that first time.
When you were, you know, coming up in the U's and especially now in Rancid, I just know that, you know, when the bands that I was in started having some success and I was meeting certain people from certain bands or even, you know, like athletes like that, did you find yourself being sort of starstruck? I mean, I held it in pretty well, but on the inside, I was going crazy when I would meet, like when I met Fat Mike for the first time, I was like freaking out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm, honestly, and in all honesty, I still am that way 100%. Where like I don't know if it's being from a small town or just my perspective on, you know, entertainment and music and arts and sports, but like I still like totally geek out on that shit, and I still get like shy and awkward and whatever when it's just like somebody I'm a huge fan of, and I've been that way for years. Where I really enjoy being a fan, you know. I think it keeps me more passionate about music, and I feel like it's too easy that people kind of get a little bit jaded and I guess just used to it in our industry, where it's not a big deal anymore, and they're not really like, they don't have any like musical heroes that are alive or whatever it is. And to me, it's like, no, man, I'm not above admitting it. Like, I'm a total fan. Even if these people are my friends, I'm still a super fan. Like, I'm a total Green Day super fan, nerd on that.
I saw some pictures on Instagram with you hanging out with Billy Joe, I think on New Year's or something, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they've become good friends of mine, and I still am like a super fan. Like, it just, there's like the two different versions almost. It's like the people you know and hang out with, and there's the people like you have posters of on your wall.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like they're two different versions, you know. And
you know how people tell you like don't meet your heroes because, you know, they'll let you down. The first time I've met the guys in Metallica twice, and you know, you're my age. I'm sure you listen to like Master of Puppets and the Black Album and all that stuff growing up. They've always been kind of this pinnacle for me as far as learning to play guitar. And when I met them, I was so worried that they were going to let me down, but I got to say, man, they were the nicest people I've ever met in my entire life.
That's awesome. I love when that happens, man. Like I always am like, I'm like skeptical, but I want to meet people. I love to like, you know, I love seeing that they're human and that, you know, they're just like you and I and everybody else. It's like, I love that. But at the same time, I'm always worried because there have been those few that are just fucking dickheads, and you're just like, you're like, no, like this is so much better when I had no idea, you know?
Well, you know, when you were like a kid and maybe you'd go see a show or you'd get the chance to maybe meet somebody that you respected or whatever, and maybe they were a dick to you. I've had that happen to me when I was young, going to concerts and shows, and you start to be like, man, they're a dick. And then when you get on tour and you start doing what they're doing and you realize that, man, not every day on tour is a great day.
Yeah. You realize like that burned out feeling, and sometimes you're just tired, and
you're not always in that headspace to like take 100 pictures and sign 100 things. And it's just,
yeah.
So I think from being a musician and, you know, achieving whatever little tiny success I have, it's given me that perspective that, okay, maybe those guys that were sort of dicks once in a while, when I met them, they were just having a really bad day. They missed their kids. They missed their wife, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, you really never know. It doesn't necessarily mean it's ego or that they're whatever it might come across as. But, and it's tricky too, because it's like I love going out and meeting people when I get a chance and like saying hello. And then if that means taking a photo or that means signing some stuff or whatever. But I always laugh about how it's like there's always like a little more people want, where it's like, like you say, hey, and then like you sign something, and then you take a photo, and then like they want you to like leave their voicemail message or something, and then they want you to call their friend, and then you're FaceTiming with somebody, and then like they want your belt and they want your hat. It's like, all right, like at what point can I start like saying no respectfully and not look like an asshole?
Have people actually ask you for like your belt and stuff?
Oh, absolutely. It's so weird. We're like, these are my clothes. Like, no, sorry, but no. Like, I like it too. That's why I have it.
That's insane, man. Well, I tell you what, I had a list of notes, but we're already way off, but I like tangents. So, but I do want to know, when you started playing drums, you're living in Utah. And I mean, I've been to Utah many times. I've got friends out there. I know that the Mormon kind of conservative thing can almost be like a stranglehold around, you know, pop culture or anything underground. So what was it like? What were you listening to back then when you started playing drums and you started starting bands?
Honestly, it was so like, there was so much variety from just like punk and hardcore bands to rock and heavy music I was in love with, you know, to like reggae and ska bands and like literally like everything. You look at some of the best bands in the 90s, since that was really this era that I was coming up in and discovering music. And again, like Rage Against the Machine, Nirvana, that really struck me when it came to like learning drums, because they were like what seemed like simple drumming, yet so tasteful and would flex at just the right moments. And so you could kind of wrap your head around it and start to really, you know, for me, it was some of the best music for me to really separate the drums from. I could really hear and make out what the drums were playing and kind of get behind it and start playing some of these grooves along with it. And as a really pissed off, angry, depressed teenager, you know, there's nothing better than playing along to those records. And so that was really kind of shaping me and getting me just grooving. And then it was literally like, you know, Dookie came out around that time. And that was a massive one for me to like learn some of those songs. And that kind of helped me learn how to play faster. And then everything from Social D to The Clash to Pennywise to the band Snot. Did you ever hear Snot?
Oh, yeah. Lynn Strait, man. Some of those guys who were in Lagwagon, they jammed in that band. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Jamie Miller, a good friend of mine now, he plays in Bad Religion. He was my favorite drummer at the time for that debut album of theirs. The drumming on that was so sick, and the way he utilized the whole kit and the toms and beats. And so it was like a lot of that, mostly really angst driven shit, because I was really angry. And that was like, I mean, for me and Quinn, we were like the songwriters in the Used and wrote everything musically for our first two records. And him and I had such a diverse, you know, listen to everything. And it was kind of meshing all of those influences together that kind of created our style. Cause you can hear elements of pop and hardcore and metal and everything in the music we did, you know? So just kind of had to find a groove.
I always loved with the Used. I mean, just exactly what you're saying from the first time I saw you guys live and then I bought the record, there was so many influences throughout each song. I mean, even some of the pretty more melodic songs would just get crazy in the middle. And I love that the name of the band was The Used, which to me sounds like a total old school punk rock band.
Rad.
So it was just really cool that, I don't know, there were a lot of bands kind of doing this scream sing thing back then, but you guys had something going on a little bit different. Can you tell me kind of where that came from? Like when Bert got into the band, what was his influence on the songs?
So when Quinn and I finally pulled the plug on the band we were doing at the time, because it was one of those ones where every song was different, where we had our like kind of new metal-ish song and a punk rock song and a ska punk song and a funk song. And it was just like, all right, what are we doing? Like, you know, and something clicked where we just learned to, rather than trying to emulate our influences, we let them influence us and just tried to make our own version of all of it mixed. And then of course we stumbled upon the New Noise Refused video had come out around that time. And that was a game changer, dude. We saw that and it was literally like we were searching for something and just found it, you know? And again, it was like, all right, let's not go out and try to recreate what they've done, but this is fucking brilliant. And, you know, the name couldn't have fit that album better with The Shape of Punk to Come.
Can you imagine if they would have named it that, but it wouldn't have been so groundbreaking and amazing?
Right? The follow-up, maybe not.
they had some balls on them to name name that record that.
Right? I mean, they had some balls on them to do everything they did on that record.
Oh, yeah.
It was brilliant. And that, like, literally changed the game for us, where, you know, we wrote our first song together, Maybe Memories. That was the first song off our first record. And that was our very first one Quinn and I dove into. And it was literally us kind of, I mean, you can hear it. We literally were biting off Refuse on that song.
Yeah.
In the bridge that took it, took it, took it, took it. Like we fully were like, but it was more like a tip of the hat than trying to bite off them, you know? But so then we were just like trying to find that perfect last piece of the puzzle. And we had known Bert. We had played with him for years. He was in like a pop punk band. Then he was in like a straight edge hardcore band. So we knew the kid could scream and he could sing, and he had just come out of rehab, you know, classic Utah story from a straight edge hardcore band to meth to rehab. But when we linked up with him, he was just coming from a whole different place too, where you had him, like his favorite music at the time was like Ink and Dagger and stuff like that. And then Jeff was like obsessed with Mr. Bungle and things like that. And then Quinn was getting real into like Radiohead and shit like that. But I was hung up on like punk rock. And so literally we'd mix those styles and it just turned out to be what it was. And then one of my favorite things we'd always talk about and that I loved with Bert was, as much as we all loved hardcore metal, we didn't want to do something that was just simply screaming for the sake of screaming. We wanted to make it count. And like, we loved that Bert would only scream something if that resonated with him with the lyrics, not because it would sound cool to have a scream at this part kind of thing. So we would have a really mellow song or something that maybe the whole bridge, we would have him just screaming in the background while we were throwing things at him and beating him and doing stuff to just like get some sincerity out of him. And it was awesome because it just felt more sincere, you know, and like he meant it. And we just, you know, tried to make it count when he would scream and not just simply like, you know, it wasn't a guitar. Like, now we click on the distortion pedal, you know, it was like, no, let's do it where it counts.
I remember seeing you guys on Warped Tour. I believe it was in 2003 on the main stage. And it might have been a couple days on the tour, but I remember one time he had a trash can up there because he would scream so hard that he would actually start throwing up.
Oh, that happened all the time back then. I mean, it was a mix of just not quite being conditioned for how hard he would try to go.
Yeah.
And just simply how hard he would go. But it was never a fun thing. He didn't like it. It was so harsh on his vocals. People thought it was like a gimmicky thing. And it was like, are you kidding? Does anybody want to throw up? Like, you know, and it was like, and we don't want to fucking watch that happen. Like while we're on stage, like, you know, like, but, yeah, he would just for a while there, he would go so hard that it would just come out literally.
So you guys got Bert in the band, you know, you wrote the song, everything, you guys are getting everything going. Are you playing shows at that point? Like just around town? Like what's the scene like there where you're at?
Yeah, the scene was kind of a lack thereof in a good way and a bad way. You know, it kept it from being very cliquey and in the way of like, there wasn't any like segregation in our scene because it didn't exist. So we'd literally like have to rent out a veterans hall and the show would be like a punk band with a hip hop guy and a metal band and a Artie band or something, you know what I mean? It was just like, and there was just camaraderie between just local musicians because we were all in it together where we didn't have a proper venue that was supporting local music. And, you know, so we'd play at a skate park, we'd play at a rented veterans hall, we'd play at a senior citizens center, wherever we could find just an open room to rent and have a show. And so all of our previous bands, we had played the shit out of this area like that. And then our first one with Bert, we were all excited. It was at a comedy club and we played our first show. Like 300 people came out, which was awesome. That was massive at that time.
Yeah.
And we were just promoting it, you know, like members of these former bands and whatever. And we had a great show, but everybody literally just stood there motionless. Every song we played except one of them was on our first record. Everybody just stood there staring at us and we were like, is anybody into this? Like, I know we took a chance, but fuck. Like, and then like the reception afterward was nothing but positive. We're like, okay, I guess they were just standing there staring at us because they were soaking it all in, not hating it. So, but it was awesome. It went really well despite the awkwardness of everybody standing there. But then afterward, the guy that ran the club told us we couldn't play there anymore. And that they didn't want our kind of music there. And it's like, what the fuck? You know? And so we had nowhere to play.
I mean, were you guys the first band to play that comedy club? Like what other kinds of bands were playing there at the time?
No, not at all. I mean, we live in a college town, you know? So it's a lot of like college rock and just like shit like that, you know? And basically anything heavy at all.
Well, yeah.
Was very like, no, you know? But it's like, are you kidding? We didn't hurt anything, like nothing, you know, and we brought in a lot of people, but the same guy was always like, you know, he still to this day runs clubs in our local scene and gets a lot of praise for kind of being the backbone of the scene. But it's like, yeah, you've done a lot for this scene, but you've still never supported heavy music ever, you know, and the first signed band out of our state, you wouldn't let play at any of your clubs. So it's like, all right, you know.
Well, that's a good segue talking about being signed. So I know that you guys hooked up with John Feldman from Goldfinger. How did that come about?
That was years of me being an annoying fan.
I have a really funny story about Feldman, if I could tell you really quick. I think you'll get a kick out of it. So before I was in the Ataris, I mean, I was in bands that did some touring here and there, but really small time stuff. We had a demo that we did, and we felt like it was really good. And I had some friends in the industry, and through certain friends, I got John's phone number. And one night, my buddy dared me to call him, and I just called him up, and he answered, and he was very, very nice. And now that I think back, I was such a dumb kid. Calling John Feldman, hey, what's going on? Can I send you my record? You know, it was the dumbest thing in the world. But he was super nice. He gave me his address, and at the end of the call, he goes, oh, and hey, you know, keep this number in case we ever want to, like, you know, do something. But he said, please don't give it to anybody else.
Nice.
I've met him since then, like when I was playing with the Ataris and stuff, and I told him that story and he thought it was hilarious. So guess when you're young and stupid, you know, you do stuff like that.
Oh yeah. You do anything to get on someone's radar, you know?
Yeah. So how did you go about you said you just kept bugging him?
Yeah. I mean, I saw like their Here in Your Bedroom video debut on 120 minutes and just fucking loved it. So I instantly became a huge fan, bought the record the next day. Their first time playing Salt Lake City, went out, and me and my friends were like a few of the, you know, first to have heard of him. I believe it was a Warped Tour that they were on. And then we got to meet him. They did like a little signing and said hello. And we were telling him we were in a band, all that stuff. This is long before he was producing. But and then we just like, every time they'd play Salt Lake, we'd come out and manage to meet them and say hello again. And it got to a point where it was no longer that weird, you know, like we'd end up like back there and they're like, hey, and greeting us by name. And then around the time, just before I started the Used, I went to see them play a festival in Salt Lake, and he had produced Show Off and Messed. And we were talking about the band and struggling because our bass player Jeff was our singer at the time, but was not a good singer at all. So we were just trying to figure out what to do. And he gave me his email address and was like, yeah, well, when you've got something, send it to me. And I'm like, oh shit. And so I just hung on to that until the timing was right. We started the Used, and I named the band, and we dove into it. And I was producing these home demos that a handful of them have released. And we put them out on like some B-sides and stuff, but I just emailed him those songs, and like, I sent him a couple, and he responded and was like, these are cool. Send me more. And we were like freaking out, like, oh my God, you know? And like, he replied, let alone like he liked them.
Yeah.
So we did a couple more, or one more or something. And same thing, literally got like the same reply. Like, this is cool. Send more. And it's like, fuck, is he just, is that like an auto reply?
It's, you know, an auto reply. Yeah.
So I kind of pumped the brakes and waited till we wrote like five more songs. And then once those were done, I sent them all to him, and he literally called me the next morning. It was such a bizarre morning because I was up at like 6 a.m. My little brother was leaving on a Mormon mission. And this was like a month or so before September 11th.
Wow.
And so it was when you could like, you know, say goodbye to someone at the airport, walk them all the way to the gate, and hang out at the gate till they left. So my family and I are just sitting at the gate. I'm tired as hell. I had a cell phone at the time, and my phone rings. I'm like, what the fuck? And I answer, and it was John Feldman. And he was calling me from Norway. And he's like, hey, I'm playing a festival in Norway. Like, we're playing with Deftones and a bunch of bands. I'm like, what? Like, and then he's like, I love your songs. I want to bring you guys to LA and produce a demo for you and bring you on tour with Goldfinger.
Jeez.
And I was like, you know, like tears in my eyes. I'm like, fuck yeah. Like, and like, I called Quinn and woke him up, called Jeff, everybody, we were all crying and freaking out. And like, it just felt like we like made it, you know? And
yeah,
it was the biggest thing. Even though it meant nothing, like all we were doing was a demo, that didn't guarantee anything.
Yeah.
But just something about that was so massive to us. I'll never forget it.
So when you guys got out to LA and you were doing the recording, I mean, did he have hookups at labels? Like, what was the process of actually getting signed?
So there was a bit of a, so we went out with the intention of doing two songs. We did a Box of Sharp Objects and I want to say maybe Memories. And then we had written the song The Taste of Ink.
Yeah.
But we had a chorus that we didn't like. And it was a song, kind of a sad song about just being stuck here in Utah and the depressing lives we're all living. So we were like, we have this song we wanted to show you, but like we want to rewrite the choruses. And so we showed him and he's like, those verses are great. Like, yeah, write a chorus. And so he stayed and was like editing in a studio, and we sat in his living room with an acoustic guitar and we wrote the chorus about what we were doing. Just the fact that we were there in LA, we didn't know what that was going to mean. And, you know, so it was literally like those lyrics, like, here I am, it's in my hand and I'll savor every moment of this.
Yeah.
It was like about us being out there working with a producer and all this shit. So it was just huge, but it ended up being a really catchy, good song with a strong chorus. And so he just showed that to a couple manager friends of his that came over, Paul Gomez and John Reese, and they loved it. He showed it to a lawyer friend of his, Eric Greenspan, who represented the Chili Peppers their entire career and like had worked with like Tool and so many artists. And that dude loved it. And those guys just kind of went to town on it. Like, hey, if you want to work with us, we're eager to run with this. And we were like, holy shit. Like, yeah. And they were all great people, had done great work and were in it for the right reasons and really got what we were going for. And so they started sending it around and it was a fucking whirlwind where like we got our first showcase set up with Warner Brothers, with Craig Aronson, who we were blown away because he had signed at the drive-in. He tried to sign Green Day when he was at Capitol Records. But that was when they ended up going with Reprise. But man, he just was like the guy signing things that no one else would, but yeah, they were huge. He ended up signing us. He signed My Chemical Romance. He signed Glassjaw. He signed so many amazing artists. You know, bless the guy. He passed away a few years ago, but that guy was incredible. And then we ended up showcasing for so many other labels and suddenly we had to cut it off at like a dozen labels because we had all these major labels trying to sign us. And it was like, holy shit. Like there had never been a signed band in Utah State ever. Not a rock band. Donnie and Marie Osmond were the only signed music from our state. So we had no one's examples to learn from, no one, like, you know, no one to pick their brain and get their opinions on. So we were just winging it, you know, and luckily, you know, we really narrowed it down to a couple awesome ones. And the guys at Warner were just willing to, they were willing to let us do everything our way, from who did our artwork to what songs went on the record and what order and, you know, what the record was like and who did our album artwork and every single aspect of our record. They gave us 100% creative control and they just let us do our thing, which was unheard of because Feldman was pretty much an unknown producer at the time.
Cause I mean, and now we were certainly an unknown band through you guys and through the things he's done with Sleeping with Sirens or whoever, like all these different bands and 5 Seconds of Summer and all these different things. Before that, I mean, you, like you said, it was Show Off and Messed, right?
Yep. Yeah. There was, and neither really did a whole lot. You know, I think Messed sold a few records like decent on their first record, but really they were both just kind of different versions of Goldfinger.
Yeah.
And so it was like, this was his first thing. And I remember I had to have a phone call with the president of Warner Brothers because there was a worry that they were concerned about having like a green producer, you know, and this unknown guy producing our record. And they wanted us to maybe work with somebody else, or they just weren't going to, he wasn't being taken care of. So I had to have a call with him and was like, listen, like we're down, we want to sign with you guys, but we need to know John Feldman will be taken care of. And he's like, all right, I give you my word, he will. And I was like, that's great, but I need to hear it from John. So you need to get on with him and you need to convince him that he's going to be taken care of. And he needs to call me and tell me that. And I was like, as soon as that conversation happens, we're good, which felt really gnarly to do as a 23-year-old guy that knew nothing of this world. And I'm telling the president of Warner Brothers, like, hard stance, like, we're not doing shit till our producer convinces us that you're going to take care of him.
That loyalty, though, is amazing because, I mean, you guys, you know, he called you up, hey, I'm in Norway, I want you guys to come out here. And then he helps you guys get signed. And then because he's a green producer, you guys might leave him in the dust, but you guys didn't. I think that's amazing, man.
It was just kind of a family thing from the get-go where he took a big chance on us. You know, there was really nothing like what we were doing at the time. And so for him to be the guy to take that chance and work with us was massive to us. And to be that first guy to really, you know, take our phone call, so to speak. And so it was like, well, we're not going to let this guy, you know, put everything on the line for us just to walk away and go with some big name dude that we're just another project. And, you know, like, this guy's invested and he gives a shit and he gets what we're doing. And so there was no chance in hell we would have left him behind. And it was just kind of like both of us, like, no, we're in this together. We're all learning. And that's what made it special, because he had a lot of formulas and a lot of things he would try to put on us, but we had a lot of resistance against those things that forced him to think outside of his own box. And I think the two and that compromise challenged both sides in a really nice way, where, you know, we learned a lot about our songwriting and, you know, just dynamics and hooks and structures and stuff. But then he learned a lot about, you know, kind of breaking what he thought were rules at the time, maybe, or, you know, just kind of pushing the boundaries a little bit.
So you guys were on Warner. I know it kind of was a slow start, but, you know, when the Taste of Ink started hitting hard and things started going a little bit crazy, what was it like when you first started touring to when the band actually kind of achieved that success? Was it a steady kind of climb, or was it an overnight thing? One day it just, oh, now we're on a bus. Like, how did that go?
It felt like a really long road, even though it in retrospect, it happened pretty quickly, I would say. But one of the biggest things with the label we were saying was we would use the example that our favorite bands we discovered on our own. Like, you know, it was whether it was at a show in person or like, you know, the skate videos or 120 minutes and things like this. But it was like just this kind of mainstream, like, release of catchy single wasn't what we were interested in, you know? And so we told them that the biggest thing we wanted to do was tour. We wanted to get out there and in people's faces and let them learn of our band themselves and not release a video or a single. So we did like a homemade video of A Box Full of Sharp Objects that just kind of released digitally pretty much. And was like a DVD handout thing we'd give out at shows and whatever. And that was like our quote unquote first single, which we knew wasn't like a catchy, hooky single type of song. But the idea was just to get people's attention, where we're like, no, we don't want like a radio hit. We want to just get on people's radar. So we toured and toured like crazy, playing for everyone and anyone. We were playing shows where the only people at them were the other bands we were playing with, you know? And it was just like kind of discouraging. Like, I remember we bought a motorhome, this like little ship motorhome to tour in, because we didn't want to do the van thing. And we started touring and we just were like, yeah, we made it. And suddenly we're playing for no one. And you'd get a day off and like go in a record store or something somewhere and ask if they had our record, and it wasn't even like in their system. And it was like, Jesus, like, didn't realize this is what it was going to be like. You know, like, this feels like we're an unsigned band without a record and we're just out playing for no one, because no one's heard of us. And then it was like the kind of thing where the fourth time you make it to a city, you know, suddenly there are people there and they're singing your songs and wearing shirts. And it was just the first 2.5 years or something we toured, our longest break at home was 10 days.
Wow.
And it was just, we just lived on the road. And so by doing that, you know, playing Warped Tour on those small stages, walking around the crowd with Walkmans and putting headphones on people and playing them our music, trying to sell them our CD, like, Bert would do that with us. We would just like literally wander around the crowd trying to get people to listen to us. And just through that hard work, by a year later, we were one of the headliners on Warped Tour and our record had gone gold, you know, and we could afford a tour bus, and, you know, and so it was a lot of work. But I think, you know, a year from the touring we were doing, playing for no one, to being like a headliner on Warped Tour and having a gold record is pretty fucking good for the digital era, you know, but it was a lot of work.
I was going to tell you, you were talking about Bert and at Warped Tour, I had one other little thing that just popped into my head. I remember one day, I think I think we were watching Avenged Sevenfold, maybe. I'm not sure. But I was on the stage, on the side of the stage, and then all of a sudden I see Davey Havoc pulling up with, like, a scooter, and, like, Bert was on the back of the scooter, or maybe Davey was on the back of the scooter, and Davey had this little black umbrella, I guess, to stay out of the sun, and it's just, it's burned into my mind, those two guys riding a scooter around backstage.
That's awesome. Hell yeah.
But
that's so rad. That sounds perfect.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like 2003, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was such an incredible lineup, too. Like,
it was amazing.
Oh, my
yeah.
God. That year was, like, that was, Rancid was on that year. That was when I became friends with the guys. They were one of my favorite punk bands of all time. And Rancid was on it, Dropkick Murphys, AFI, like, and then we had like Thrice and Glassjaw and who else?
I'm trying to remember. I think
it was so good though.
It was really, like, really good, yeah.
Just a perfect lineup of whatever you want to call our genre and like punk rock, you know, it was all the best bands. It was incredible.
I think actually one of those times that I actually talked to you backstage at Warped Tour or at catering or whatever, you had a Rancid shirt on. So I think it's really, I mean, you said they're one of your favorite bands. How did, you know, what led you to leave the Used, if you don't mind to talk about that?
Oh, no, I don't mind at all. I was fired from the Used.
Okay.
I would have never left. That was my band. Like I said, I started the band, named the band, got assigned. That was my band, you know, but unfortunately, you know, when the band started, we were three sober guys with one recovering addict, that, you know, all he was doing was drinking a whole lot and smoking a lot of weed, but at least he wasn't using needles anymore. And so it was like, hey, like, at least, you know,
that's a win, man.
Yeah. So we were just happy that that was where he was at. And, but then, you know, when you get that kind of success, it can catch up to people. And, I mean, it's all in the past now, but at the time, everybody was getting quite caught up in the sex, drugs, and rock and roll cliche. And, you know, my girlfriend, who was my fiance at the time, and is still one of my best friends, she toured with us as our, like, merch person the whole time I was in the band, from our first tiniest shows ever to arena shows. And so, you know, I was just in a very monogamous relationship. I had been sober and drug-free my entire life. And I was just really into like the business and the work of being in a band. I didn't give a fuck about the party and the, like, you know, all that shit. So, but in like 2005, maybe, we were touring so much. And at this point we could afford a couple buses. So we decided for the sake of everyone's comfort, we would do a sober bus and a party bus.
Yeah.
And that was for rather than a band bus and a crew bus. It was like, no, let's let everybody just be comfortable. Like, you know, so I was on the sober bus with all of our crew guys that were sober and everybody else in the band were on the party bus. And it was exactly what you'd think, where they got busted at a border crossing with cocaine on our passports and weed in the bus. And, you know, they all had to go show their assholes to Border Patrol. And it was like, okay. Meanwhile, like the sober bus were just sitting on the curb waiting. And it was like, just kind of gnarly, but like, but because of that and me being the only guy on that sober bus, it just started creating kind of what I can only figure as kind of a wall between us.
Yeah.
And then while we were diving into making the third record, they, all of a sudden Bert was like letting me know that him and Quinn were going to write the record. And I was like, wait, what? Quinn and I always write all the music. Like, but okay, you know, like I don't get it, but okay. And then it just seemed weird and off. And then like a week later, Quinn called me and he fired me from the band because he said that I was too different and that they wanted somebody that would go party and hang out with them like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I literally was to this day was like, I think I'm the first person to be kicked out of a band for being sober.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then, I was cracked, man. I was heartbroken. I was trying to talk Quinn out of it and they weren't having it. They wanted somebody to party. And so they made that record without me and then got a buddy of ours from Salt Lake City, Dan, to play drums, which Dan's a fucking awesome drummer, you know, and is great. So they did good in that way, but you know, it just changed the whole dynamic, because it was what Quinn and I had in our chemistry that was making that music what it was. And then Bert would paint over top of it, you know? And so obviously if you listen to the records, it's just, it very much changed the style of the band.
Well, I know that Quinn is no longer in the band. Are you guys close now, or is there still like a rift between you guys?
Oh no. Quinn's one of my best friends. I love that guy. We, you know, like we hadn't spoken quite a while. I didn't talk to anybody, no one take my calls or anything for like a year, which was a huge bummer. And then I remember like a year after I'd been in the band, Bert called me at like 3 a.m. on his birthday. And I was just like, kind of like, the fuck do you want? You know?
Yeah.
And he's like, it's my birthday. I'm like, did you call me to tell me it's your birthday? Like, you know, and then we ended up talking for like 4 hours, and it was great. And
wow.
I loved the dude. You know, I still do. He's Bert. He's got his thing, you know, and he loves to talk shit. He loves to be a dick. But in the end, like, I've always loved the guy. But
that's good, man.
So we made everything cool. And you know, Jeff and I squashed things over time. And I was just really hurt, you know, like they didn't have my back or stand up for me. And then Quinn was the one that did it. And it was like, I had a beef for a while. And then eventually I was playing a show filling in for Goldfinger in Belgium.
Yeah.
And the Used were playing that show as well.
That was in 2010, and, right?
Sure.
Well, I did some research, and there was a little like footnote that said filled in for Darren and Goldfinger. Oh, okay. 2010. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. yeah. And it was cool. And I didn't know what to think. Feldman gave me a heads up like, hey, just so you know, the Used will be there. And I'm like, oh, fucking great. You know? And then he was like, what are you going to do? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to hug him or punch him. Like, I don't know. I'll know when I get there, you know? And then like, I thought about it and I was like, you know what? Like it is what it is. Like what's done is done. All I can do is take the high road and just try to be a good person. And, you know, and when I saw Quinn, I was just like, get over here. And like, just gave him a huge hug, and he was so timid and whatever. And
thought he was going to get killed, man.
Yeah. Rightfully so. But, and then it was cool. And then like, we ran into each other a few other times and places, and it was always cool. And then we had some heart to hearts, and it was just like, look, you know, like he really had a lot of accountability for his fuck up, and he knew that he fucked up, and what, you know, he paid the price for it. If you looked at what happened to the band, I mean, they got dropped from their label. They, you know, had a falling out with management. They lost their entire team because they just kept making a shitty decision over and over. And it just, they really paid for it. And yeah. So it's like, yeah, I don't need to be a dick and like, you know, try to make some point that life hasn't already made to them. And him and I hit it off, and I really love the dude. We've actually been writing music for the last couple of years together, working on a project together, and it's incredible. And he's one of my favorite people on earth to collaborate with musically. And he's so talented. Like, I love the dude to death. So all of that stuff's in the past, and I have nothing bad to say about any of them. Like, I love that guy for sure.
That's awesome, man. And that leads us up to, you know, joining Rancid, which that had to be a mind fuck, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We're like, so there was 2 months that I was in no band, and I had no interest in being in a band, you know, where I was like, all right, if I can just like focus on working hard, being ambitious, really trying to keep my career on track, you know, and really trying to take care of this band, bringing Bert tea and medicine and everything when he's throwing up and canceling sound checks because he was up till 5 a.m. eating shrooms. It's like, I just was literally like, working so hard to keep that band together so we'd have a career and could do that shit long term. And I was like, you know, I tried to be completely honest and just a good person, and it got me fucking fired. Like, you know, and I was like, no one did anything. The label management, no one stepped in to have my back and say, no, you shouldn't do this, you know? And so I was just like, this is not a industry I want to be a part of, like, at all. And I hadn't played drums. I just stopped and was just enjoying my summer, trying not to think about anything. Literally spent every day on the water in my boat and just like tried to forget about reality. And then the coolest thing was Max Weinberg would call me like every other day and give me like pep talks.
Like the Max Weinberg?
Yeah, E Street Band, Bruce Springsteen,
oh my
Max
God.
Weinberg.
That's awesome,
and it
man.
Was pretty incredible. He was so encouraging, so cool, from like putting me in touch with his lawyer to talk to about legal stuff to just simply encouraging me to keep playing drums and not give up. And the craziest thing he said to me, I'll never forget, was he's like, you know, when Bruce broke up the E Street Band, Ringo Starr would call me all the time and give me pep talks, saying that he could relate to when his band broke up, you know, and he's like,
his band being the Beatles,
the fucking Beatles, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he's like, so I just figured if I can kind of return the favor, paying it forward kind of thing. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like,
is this
Ringo
real life?
Ringo Starr pep talking Max Weinberg to Max Weinberg pep talking me, like, oh my God. Like,
that's
what
insane.
The fuck is this?
That is, you know, insane, I mean?
It,
man.
It was blowing my mind. And so, the coolest day was Ransom was playing two nights in Salt Lake City. And I was driving up with my best friend Spike to go see Rancid, and was on the phone with Max the whole way up there, you know, 45-minute drive. He's just talking to me and pep talking me and stuff. We get there and the guys are super cool. We're hanging out and they were like, hey, stick around after the show. We want to hear what happened. That's fucked up. And watch the show. Lars and the guys are giving me shout outs on stage. We all hang out afterward on the bus, and I tell them the whole story, and they're just like, that's fucked up. You were the only one we liked in that band anyway. Like, you know, they were just being rad. Like,
yeah.
And they're like, come back out tomorrow. You know, we want to hang more. And so I went out the next day, you know, me and Brett Reed shooting pool the whole time till they played, and just hanging out and talking music and stuff. And I'll never forget, like, the end of the night, I was leaving and Tim's just like, you know, keep your shit up. Keep playing. Something's going to work out for you. I know it. And I'm just like, thanks, man. And he's like, yeah, I'll be in touch. And like a couple of days later, he'd hit me up like, hey, man, hope you're well. Like, just, you know, on playing wherever tonight. And I was just so stoked. Like, no way. This guy's like one of my punk rock heroes.
Yeah.
And he's just like dropped me a line, encouraging me. So I started playing drums. I was like, fuck it. I'm going for it. And every day for a week, I just started playing. Like, I made a playlist. Everything from jazz to fucking everything heavy and groovy and punk and everything in between. And I just was laying in my drums every day. And that was a Monday. I dove into it. That Friday, Tim hit me up and told me to call him. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, okay. So I call him up and he's all like sad as hell sounding. And he's like, man, he's like, Brett Reed just quit Rancid.
Jeez.
And I'm like, fuck. And I'm like bummed thinking he's calling me, telling me my fucking favorite band broke up.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, like, God damn it. You know? And he's like, yeah, we have this 3.5-week UK tour in 5 days. And he quit. And I'm like, fuck, man, I'm so sorry. And he's like, yeah. So we want to know, will you do the tour? And I literally, dude, my eyes just welled up with water and I was just like stomach churned. And without even thinking, I was like, fuck yeah, I'll do it. And he's like, hell yeah. And like, he's like, all right, I'm gonna have Lars call you. I'm like, all right, cool. And, you know, ran inside and blasted out my ass. Cause I was like instantly just like sick. And like, and then Lars calls me and gives me like 25 songs to learn in 2 days.
Jeez.
And I'm like, holy shit. And then I flew out to LA and we met up. I had to ship my drums to England because
wow.
It was committed. But I was like, oh my God, like, all right, well, here we go. And so we met up with all this just rental backline. They didn't have their guitars or anything because everything was already in England. And so we meet up at this little ghetto rehearsal spot in LA, whatever was available last minute. And they walk in the room and are just like, hey, and they all give me hugs and stuff. They're like, all right, let's play Roots Radical. And they, Lars just started it. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, they've been in here for 1 minute. We're diving in. No talk, nothing. So we play the song and they're all like, fuck yeah, like so stoked afterward. And then they're like, all right, let's play a fast one. And they're like, let's play It's Quite All Right. I'm like, all right. And I love that song, but it, you know, there was just a lot of room where you could have added some little bit bigger fills and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But otherwise I love like keeping stuff true to the original. Just put things where it makes sense, you know? And so I just did like a couple little, you know, my style fills in it. And when that song ended 45 seconds later or whatever, you know, no, it's like a 2-minute song, but they were all just like, yeah, like so stoked. And I'm like, it meant the world to me. But meanwhile, my stomach's still in knots and I'm like still so nervous. And they're like, let's take a break. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, we just started.
Just
we
did played two 4 songs
of music.
Yeah.
You know? And so we go outside and I'm sitting at this table and like, you know, there are a couple of Lars off, they're having a cigarette or whatever and making phone calls and shit. I don't really know what's going on. I'm just sitting there patiently. And then they come over and sit down. And Matt Freeman was like, all right, so we want you to be a permanent member of the band. You know, full 25% member. Are you down?
Jeez.
And I'm just like, holy shit. Like, yeah, I'm down. And I'm like, all right, awesome. Let's go play. And like, we went back, played like maybe 6 more songs. And then that was it. They called it for the day. They're like, nah, you're good. I'm like, what the fuck? And then like, they gave me 15 more songs to learn that night. And then we rehearsed again the next day and only played for like a half hour. And we hadn't even played every song that we were going to play in the first show.
Wow.
And they were like, yeah, we're good. And then that was it. We left and went to England and started tour.
How was that first show?
Crazy. It was incredible. It was so terrifying, but that just made it that much more incredible.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget like the nerves and, you know, and the fact that we had to play songs that I hadn't even played at the band. And it went flawless. I mean, it was fucking great. And I shouldn't say flawless because there was one song, St. Mary, I'll always remember, like has like a kick drum kind of intro. And I fucked up and just played like the double time beat through that kick drum part. I was like, oh no, shit. Like, oh well. And it just kind of worked. And we just played it off like it was on purpose. But other than that one fuck up, everything went perfect and it was great. And every show since then has been great. So.
I mean, to go from kind of being down and not even knowing if you want to be in the music industry ever again to, oh, I just got to join as a, you know, an equal member, my favorite band.
Yeah, it was nuts. It was all of
that's like a movie, man.
Oh, absolutely. It completely is. And like it just the whole thing, you know, I mean, it was a trip because I just went from like these guys being one of my favorite punk bands ever to being just my bandmates. It was like weird, you know, like it was really weird. And you learn a lot about everybody, like, you know, but there's no closer relationship than being in a band with someone, you know?
No, definitely.
I mean, everybody says it's like a marriage and, you know, I just, without dating, dove into marriage with these guys. We all got to know each other really quick, but it was a trip, but a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Well, tell me about the new record, Troublemaker.
What do you want to know?
Well, I mean, I know it wasn't your first one. You actually played, your first record you played on was Let the Dominoes Fall, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been on 3 records now.
Okay.
You know, it's so weird writing a Rancid record. It's fun, but so different where like, I mean, it, for the most part, Tim's like the main songwriter in the way that maybe he'll come in with a song idea or something and we'll show it to all of us. But the weirdest part that happens every record we make that's so bizarre, and this happens so much, but like Gerwitz will be there. He'll produce everything we do. He always has. And Tim will have like a song and he'll show it to all of us. Just sit down with his acoustic, strum something that maybe has kind of a loose chorus idea, and he'll play it for all of us like one time. And Gerwitz is like, rad, let's record it. And we record everything live, musically. And so we're like, okay. And I'm trying to just kind of remember, you know, the rough tempo and arrangement stuff. And so we'll sit down and we'll play it. And there's been so many times where that first time we play the song is the one and only time. And that's what you hear on the record.
Wow, man.
Like it's all of us, you know, like Lars and Matt, like, hey, what were the chords again? And he'll show them and we just kind of wing it and just kind of put the Rancid vibe on it and we'll play it and that'll be it. And then they'll overdub maybe some leads or or, you know, if a guitar needs fatten up or something, but then lay down vocals and that's it. And so it's just a trip to make a record like that, where we used to, you know, making a used record was 100% opposite and very in depth and, you know, a much slower process. So it's just a very different experience.
I know that you said you did, you know, the majority with Quinn, the writing for the used, as far as the music goes. Have you been able to kind of express yourself with Rancid and like bring some ideas to the table?
Yes and no. Like, in the way that I can throw out a suggestion or, you know, an idea and whatever, and they're very receptive to that and will listen. But at the same time, the way these songs are written, so often, there's not a whole lot of room to do that. You know, it's kind of, and you know what it is, where it's like, I was very careful when I joined the band and took a lot of time to think about it, where I was like, okay, as a fan, I want to look at this as a fan. Like, I would be super bummed to know Brett Reed left the band. If some guy came in and just started overplaying the fuck out of these songs and just like over flashy and whatever, I'd be super bummed and that would annoy me. But if some guy came in and all he did was exactly the same as Brett Reed, but he wasn't Brett Reed,
yeah,
I'd be bummed at that, you know? And so I just tried to kind of find my own voice, where I don't want to change the sound of the band, because it's a great sound and I didn't want to fuck that up, you know? And it was like, there's some room for a little bit of stuff here and there. You can, you know, dance around a vocal and do some accents and things to bring out a vocal or a guitar or bass part. But for the most part, it is what it is. I mean, there's those few, you know, handful of grooves that you hear with Rancid. There's kind of like our ska like vibe. There's our hardcore fast vibe. There's the more like street punk kind of mid-tempo vibe and Ramonesy vibe. So it kind of just creates a, I already know what I should do. So I don't dive in as deep, because it doesn't feel like there's that room, you know? So there's room for me to do my thing, but respectfully to the process and the music, I don't in most cases, because I want to keep it true to the original sound, you know?
Do you play with a click track most of the time or in the studio?
No, it kind of is hit or miss. I love playing to a click, but at the same time, I can appreciate that there might be a little more rawness if you don't.
Yeah.
And so it's really kind of, we kind of wing it song by song. Like, usually our engineer, by the time we're diving into something, they'll have already figured out a tap to get like pretty close click to what, you know, we had just heard. And then, or if we're writing or something or jamming something, we'll maybe turn on a click here and there. But for the most part, I don't know, it's probably half and half, you know, like, I prefer playing to a click, just because I like knowing I'm keeping it in time,
yeah,
and everything's solid. But at the same time, you know, Brett and those guys aren't going to let it fly if I'm rushing or yeah, you know, fucking something up. So even when there's no click, they're going to be. I mean, Gerwitz has played with some of the sickest drummers. You know,
yeah, so totally, man. I mean,
he's going to know if I'm fucking up.
He played with Brooks. Brooks is pretty insane.
Oh, I love that dude.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, man, I've had you on the phone for a really long time, so I'm not going to take up a lot more of your time, but I do want to ask you, this show is called That One Time on Tour. Sometimes the guests prepare like a story, but if you didn't, that's fine. You've done a lot of touring with the used, with Rancid, you know, you've been all over the world. Do you have something that sticks out in your mind, like a story that just you would like to share with us?
Honestly, so many pop up, from Mischief to just, you know, incredible experiences. Getting to play with like some of my favorite artists, like Flea came and played a song with us one time.
That's
things like
awesome.
That. You know what stands out maybe most recently is just our touring with Green Day. Like I said, they've been one of my favorite bands since I was 15. And I just fucking love that band. But I watch their show every single night, because it's like I get a chance to watch Green Day side stage. Like, yeah, you bet your ass I'm going to do it. And so I would watch every night. And at a point, Trey was like, hey, like, bring your in-ears and I'll let you use one of my packs and you can listen to the show through one of my packs. And
oh,
I was like,
man,
like, oh shit, that'd be sick, you know? And so I'm like sitting there watching. We're somewhere in Europe. If I thought about it for a moment, I could think of where, but, and I'm standing there side of stage and watching the show. And it was so incredible, like listening through his pack. And then all of a sudden I'm getting like motioned to go back behind the drums. I'm like, wait, what? And like, everybody's like pushing me and motioning me like, no, Trey's waving you over. So I go running back there to his tech, Nathaniel, and they're playing their Op Ivy cover, Knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And which, of course, like, I know they bring people up to play that song. Like, they used to switch out the whole band, but now they always bring someone up to play guitar. And so I run back there, and he just hands me some sticks. He's like, Trey wants you to play. And I'm like, oh, shit. Like, you know, like, completely unprepared and just, like, caught me off guard. And I just went from zero to fucking out of my mind instantly.
That's awesome, man.
Sure enough, Trey's just waving me up, and I just start, like, I step up next to him, start hitting the snare with him, and he just steps out from the kit, and I slide in like we didn't miss a beat in the middle of the song, and just played that with him, and ended up doing it like three other times during the tour too. And that was some of my favorite experiences ever, where like I'm behind the kit and, you know, Mike Dirnt looks over and is like, hey, like, didn't even realize I slipped in. And Billy Joe turns around, same thing, just reacting like, well, like, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, like, fucking, I'm behind the kit, behind Billy Joe, playing on stage with Green Day. Like, this is fucking mind blowing, you know. And not only is it, I get that feeling every night with Rancid.
Yeah, but yeah.
To do that with Rancid and Green Day the same night and several times, that's definitely one that stands out as the most recent.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like when you get done playing drums with Green Day, it's not like you go to your factory job, then you go get to play with Rancid.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome. Yep. Okay, man. Well, I'm not going to take up any more of your time. I would like to know about the future. You've got, you know, stuff coming out with Rancid. What's on the agenda for you guys?
This is going to be a big year for us. We're making some big announcements in the next couple of weeks, but we're going to be touring a lot this year, playing a lot of shows, and I have some really cool, exciting stuff we're working on. So that'll all be announced in the next couple of weeks. So all I can say is people need to stay tuned for that. But it's going to be a good, busy year. I'm excited. And then hopefully, I've been talking about it for far too long without anything coming out, but the music Quinn and I recorded, we've had an EP finished for a while. We're just sorting out details with the vocals and kind of getting on the same page with additional people. And so that's kind of held up our process, but we've had an EP finished for quite a while that we want to get out. So that'll hopefully see the light of day this year as well. So should be a good year.
Cool, man. Well, where can people find you on the social media outlets?
I'm on Instagram, just under my full name, Brandon Steinekert. The weird ass spelling, B-R-A-N-D-E-N. And then, Steinekert. So I'm on Instagram, and then of course, like, Twitter is 801-801-PUNX. And yeah, I mean, those are the main ones, but yeah, I'm active. I'm on there, and you can come see what me and my girlfriend are up to, because we like to live fun adventures, and, you know, from swimming with sharks to playing in deserts and mountains. So
sounds cool, man.
See what we're up to.
Well, hey, man, I want to thank you again so much for coming on the show, and I can't wait to hear the news about Rancid and what you guys have coming up this year. And I wish you luck. I hope everything keeps working out really well for you, and thank you once again, man.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate all the support. Thanks for having me.
No problem. I'll talk to you soon, man. Thanks.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye. So there it was, my conversation with Mr. Brandon Steinekert from Rancid and The Used. I had such a good time talking to Brandon. Definitely going to have him back in the future for a part two. Yeah, that's going to do it for this week, guys. Thank you so much for checking out episode number 40, the big 40. It's crazy that we've come this far. I've almost been doing this podcast for a year. It just keeps getting better and better. Next week on the show, I get to sit down with Mr. Sean Colon, director of the awesome documentary of Fat Wreck. If you guys are not familiar with Fat Records, you should be. It's one of my favorite record labels. It's a big part of my musical upbringing. So make sure to come back next week for my conversation with Sean Colon from a Fat Wreck documentary. Thank you guys for always being supportive, and I appreciate all of it. I appreciate the tweets and the posts on IG that you tag me on. and the Facebook stuff. Facebook's actually doing better. We used to not have hardly anybody on Facebook, but now it's starting to take off. So going over to all the social medias at TOTOT Podcast. You want to become a sponsor or you have a question or whatever, hit me up, TOTOTPodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget about the hotline. Just call 1-765-372-8818. And that's going to do it for episode 40. I cannot wait till we hit 50 and then 60 and then 70. I've got guests planned out and booked through the next 2 months. So we've got all kinds of crazy stuff coming up. So I'm going to get out of here, but not before I play a song off of Rancid's most recent record that's out on Epitaph. It is called Troublemaker. And the song that I'm going to play is Telegraph Avenue. So have a great week, everybody. And I will see you next time on That One Time on Tour. See ya.
Skies was blue. You can find me on the corner of Durant and Telegraph Avenue. When I was only 17, I knew what I had to do. So I grabbed my left-handed guitar and I headed out to Telegraph Avenue. Him against the machine. For that he spent 3 months in jail, but he said he would do it again. Governor Rankin had enough, so the National Guard they pushed on through. Tear gas and riot police on Telegraph Avenue. To you, I can still hear your voice on Telegraph Avenue.
Did you poo poo? Daddy can smell it. Did you poo poo?
Yes.
Say I poo poo. Did you poo poo?
I poo pooed.
I poo pooed. I poo pooed. Right? He poo pooed.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.